5. In the morning, the farm was in turmoil. Willard noticed, upon coming into the kitchen, that the statue of the Madonna was missing. He told Malcolm, on their way to the milk house, that Duncan had been up to one of his tricks. When they entered the milk house, they found Duncan there, sitting in the corner. "What's become of the statue?" Willard stood over him and demanded. "Huh?" Duncan behaved as if he had been awakened from sleep. "What's become of the statue?" Willard repeated. "Statue?" Duncan was severely puzzled, gazing upward, all of his wrinkles pressed into deep furrows. "She's missing from above the basin," Willard accused. "She was gone from there when I was shaving," Duncan replied. "Gone where?" Willard was angry. "She was laying on the table." "And where is she now?" Duncan hesitated. "Probably gone to heaven," he said. "We'll get Howard up here after the chores are done," Willard said to Malcolm as a way of threatening Duncan. Then to Duncan, "It'd be best for all of us if you was to get her back in place before Nora is up." Nora was up early, uncontrollably upset, nearly in hysterics. She called Doreen, who dispatched Howard to the barn. Soon all of the men were in the kitchen. Duncan, however, stubbornly insisted that the last he had seen of the Madonna was when she was laying on the table. Even Willard was close to losing his temper at Duncan's stubbornness. Nora warned that there would be no Christmas Eve dinner, in fact, no Christmas at all, until the Madonna reappeared. Howard insisted over Duncan's objection that it was drizzling outside, that the two of them go out for a short walk. Nora was left stirring about the kitchen distractedly. Willard and Malcolm went back to the milking. As Howard and Duncan stepped from the back porch, Travis slammed the door of his truck shut. He had driven it almost up to the back door. "Is Mother up yet?" he asked Howard without waiting for an answer. There had been an argument, he told Nora, and Alice had left the house when it was still dark. He had to admit that he had been rough with her. "Had you been drinking?" Nora inquired, stable now, but not by any means as upset over Alice's disappearance as over that of the Madonna. "Well, I guess I had," Travis said gruffly. "Then I can't say that I blame her for leaving," Nora said. "No doubt she's gone someplace where you won't be likely to look for her right away. Damn it, I've got work to do and there are kids to take care of." She would not be badgered into commiserating. "It sounds very much to me as if it's your fault, not hers. I'd advise you to bring the children over and wait a few hours until Alice decides to return." "I wonder where the hell she is," he shouted. She ignored his language, turning her mind calmly toward the missing statue. "It's almost a kind of coincidence," she informed him. "But we also have an absent household member this morning." "What do you mean?" he blurted. "Our Madonna is missing." He glanced at the vacant space above the basin. "Obviously Duncan's doing," she said, without acrimony. "It's only a statue," he said, feeling sorry for himself. She decided not to argue and to stop upbraiding him. "Don't worry," she said. "Alice will be back shortly. Bring the children over. They can put decorations on the tree." He went away. But by noon, Alice had not returned, nor had Duncan revealed what had happened to the Madonna. Malcolm, however, knew where both of them were. As he touched the smooth, worn railing of the staircase to the loft, he was filled with fear by his own certainty. The loft lights were burning. Even before he entered the tomb, he knew that Alice was hanging high in the arch where bales were cribbed against sliding from tiers near the rafters. He stood in dread, compassionately beneath her, his vision blurred, his frame strengthless. Seeing her purple gown swaddling her desolate body, her feet pointed downward from the whirl of her skirt like a suspended dancer's. He took off his boots and sat down in the loose strewn hay, facing the hollow center of the loft, not looking upward at Alice's body. Among the dried grasses of summer, in the vault of the seasons, he sat with her silently, hearing the sounds of harvest, the creaking pulleys and the loading belts, the doors swung open, the tractors churning underneath the eaves. One by one, the hay bales moved into the void, floated, congealed, and settled in growing tiers upon the chaff-laden floor. One by one, the new-mown bales pressed in upon their dust-joined bodies, encasing, deluging, bedecking their separate coffins with brief, long spears of fading green. Again and again the loft was emptied, refilled, and emptied, bale by bale, blade by blade, season after season, as he sat, imprisoned with her in the scattered remnants of the withered year. He looked past her, then, and saw the gleaners bending toward the soil on Wolf Island. He heard the soft December rain on the roof of the barn. He knew that he was able, without being healed, to bear this grief. But he was wild with fear that he alone would be able to bear it. He wanted time to stop, the barn to be consumed in one final conflagration. No one to know that Alice had gone to sleep in the loft with the angel of death. He descended the stairs. He saw Willard coming toward the milk house, knowing before he saw him that it was Willard alone whom he could tell, not knowing how he could tell him. When Willard met him at the door and saw Malcolm's eyes, he knew that something terrible had happened. "What is it, lad?" he asked gently, filled with fear. "She's dead," Malcolm said, almost gruffly, choking back the emotion with welled in his throat. "Up in the loft." Willard's lips parted slowly. His aged jaws sagged. His eyes darted about, dislocated, as if he were trapped in the room. "In the loft?" he asked. "Yes." They could say no more. They stood helpless together, locked in a single cell of unspeakable ruin. Gradually, Willard moved. He fumbled through his pockets for a match. "We'd best tell Howard," he said. It was Howard who called the priest and coroner. Soon the farmyard was filled with people and vehicles. An ambulance, police, the coroner, and the priest arrived. Curious villagers and concerned friends milled about the fringes of the tragedy. Malcolm, questioned briefly by the coroner, absented himself quickly from the turmoil. He took a shovel and walked through thin mist of the raw, rain-ridden day toward the ragged rocks and sparse trees where Duncan had shown him the hole. He did not know, until he was digging by the river, that Duncan had followed him. He had no doubt that the chalk fragments of the Madonna's body were submerged, swirling, undulating, in the collected waters of the hole. When he neared the place, he saw an edge of twine-wrapped burlap protruding, seeming to float upon the surface. He drew the bundle of broken chalk out of the pool. The Madonna's body had been swaddled in burlap, bound round with twine, and dashed to pieces on the rocks before being cast into the hole. It was, to Malcolm, somehow vaguely natural to try to locate and retrieve her. His impulse to bury her obscured all understanding. Settling the misshapen bundle upon the blade of his shovel, he carried the shattered Madonna like an offering through brambles and thin trees down the gradual slope toward the river. He could hear the swift running current of the swollen stream before he found a spot between two boulders with sufficient soil for the digging of a shallow grave. As he turned the soil, he became aware of a presence near a small tree grown at the edge of the boulder farthest upland from the stream. He did not have the sense of Duncan's having just arrived. It was as if this thin, grey form had been stationed at the spot before the bundle was placed down and any soil turned. Malcolm gripped his shovel midway on the handle and settled the swaddled Madonna near his feet. Duncan did not step toward him, but extended his head in bird-like fashion as he spoke. "She ain't the dead one." They gazed together at the soaked, misshapen roll of burlap. "She's only a statue," Duncan said, taking a step. Malcolm found nothing to say. Duncan's agitation was evident, and he felt no inclination to question him. Besides, he had no explanation for his digging of the grave. "Willard and me dug the old bitch in," Duncan confided, coming closer, staring at the trench Malcolm was making. "We was afraid," he admitted. Malcolm had finished his digging. He bent over and tossed the burlap bundle into the trench less carefully than he had expected. The broken chalk rattled and scraped as it struck and settled in the soil. Malcolm straightened, taking up his shovel again. Duncan looked desperately into his eyes. "Will she be put in the churchyard?" Malcolm had wondered. "It's probably up to the priest," he said. The sorrow in Duncan's features compelled him to keep speaking. "I don't know about such things," he said. "I'm not Catholic." "Neither am I," Duncan raised his voice defensively, as if he had been accused. "She wanted me to take you to church tonight," Malcolm told him. "What for?" Duncan was affronted. "She thought you might want to go." "What for?" Duncan repeated sardonically. Malcolm began to cover the remains of the desecrated statue. "Mother and Dad went to church," Duncan reflected, "but it didn't do no good. Both of them was gone when I got here." Malcolm paused at his task, astonished, gathering that Duncan felt he had been betrayed, that he had expected his father and mother and the farm of his youth to be immortal. A dull sound echoed from the rushing river, as if a solid timber struck a hollow boulder. Duncan looked about the landscape in alarm, surveying the rocks and trees, listening. Gradually, he lowered his head toward the covered grave. Then he looked directly at Malcolm, who had shouldered his shovel. "Mother is down here someplace," he said, lifting his eyes once more to search the landscape. Malcolm was stunned, confounded into silence by Duncan's direct and enigmatic tongue. He knew instantly that he had no way to discover or to decipher the riddle of the words. "I'll be going back now," he said. They made their way, following worn cattle paths, through the tangled undergrowth and scattered rocks to the open field above the farmstead. Side by side, for the last time, they walked across the fallow land, the blade of Malcolm's shovel riding above them in the gray, mist-driven air. As they neared the machine shed, Duncan twisted his head toward Malcolm in a custom curiosity. "Will you be going back to school now?" he asked. "Perhaps," Malcolm replied. It did not matter in that moment whether Duncan was being shrewd or cryptic, disoriented, or simple-minded. They walked together across the broken body of the farm. Nearly all of the Christmas festivities had to be set aside, but the children were given their gifts and allowed to put some decorations on the tree. Some of the gifts for the others remained in the parlor and were eventually stored, unwrapped, along with Nora's accumulated articles, odds and ends, and furniture. Before the turn of the year, Malcolm was notified by Travis that the dairy operation of the farm was to be leased and he would no longer be needed. Malcolm did not try to discover if the reason for his dismissal was true. He had not expected, in any case, to remain on the farm. Besides, Willard would have tried to shield him from the loft forever, never wishing him to throw the bales down. Malcolm returned to Trent, to the apartment at his grandfather's house. He read and tried to paint and write, continuously pondering his early life at sea and the squalor of the ports, always feeling distinct, undefined connections with his brief history on the farm. A deep, strange comfort came to him from looking at his print of the saltine banks. Somehow it ameliorated the horror of seeing Alice dangling from the rope of her release above him in the barn. Often he thought of visiting Duncan at Sydenham in the home, but he never did. Nor did he ever revisit the farm, despite his affection for Willard. His decision not to return came less from the feeling of having been banished than from his fear that on a sultry day in summer he would turn from the dusty village road into the driveway of the farm and see Duncan sitting on the porch.